Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the July 2nd, 2021 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a desert scene. Looks like a dried up lake bed with some small hills in the background, scrubby bushes and stuff like that. There's just a little bit of water and the bottom of the reservoir is cracked and dry. There's a cow skeleton, an old tire, dead fish with a bright sun shining over it. The headline is Mega Drought: How Scant Rainfall and 115 Degree Heat Will Affect the Western States' Future. And I think that shows up on the briefing. We'll start, as usual, with the main stories. Senate Republicans block Democrats' voting bill. What happened? Congressional Democrats in the Biden administration suffered a major defeat this week when Senate Republicans used the filibuster to block the For the People Act, a sweeping voting rights bill that would override a wave of GOP-written state voting laws. Not a single Republican voted to allow debate on the bill, leaving it 10 votes short of the supermajority needed to overcome a filibuster. The bill, which passed the House in March, is also called H.R. 1, would create the largest expansion of voting rights in decades, mandating same-day registration, guaranteeing expanded early and absentee voting, and banning partisan gerrymandering. Senator Ted Cruz called it partisan legislation written by elected Democrats, designed to keep elected Democrats in office. Senate Majority Leader Charles Schumer called the GOP's refusal to hold a vote further evidence that voter suppression has become part of the official platform of the Republican Party. Democratic lawmakers and voting rights advocates vowed to redouble their efforts to pass federal voting legislation. But with Republicans also flatly rejecting a narrower compromise measure floated by centrist Democrat Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, the Democrats appeared to be at a dead end, unless they abolish or reform the filibuster. Liberal groups vowed to aggressively pressure senators to oppose to ending the parliamentary maneuver, including Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, the Democrat from Arizona, both of whom reiterated their commitment to keeping it in place. The people did not give Democrats the House, Senate, and White House to compromise with insurrectionists, tweeted Representative Ayanna Pressley, Democrat from Massachusetts. Abolish the filibuster so we can do the people's work. What the editorial said. The filibuster must go, said the Los Angeles Times. Republicans' shameful refusal to even debate Manchin's plan shows they support Donald Trump's big lie that the 2020 election was stolen. Yes, H.R. 1 is arguably too far-reaching, but it rightly sought to enhance democracy and shore up the right to vote. If GOP senators keep stonewalling, then drastic measures are called for, and Manchin and Sinema must be pressed to recognize that. Manchin's so-called compromise deal isn't much of a deal at all, said the Wall Street Journal. Like H.R. 1, it's an overreaching assault on states' rights to manage their own elections. Manchin's putative outreach to Republicans is accepting a national ID mandate, but he'd allow alternative ID forms like utility bills, which are easily forged. And he'd still require public disclosure of the names of those spending more than $500 a year on political ads, a measure the left wants to use to stigmatize donors to conservative causes. What the columnist said. Republicans have made it crystal clear they will do anything to prevent majority rule, said Greg Sargent and Paul Waldman in the Washington Post. The question now is whether Manchin might embrace limited reforms, such as requiring only 55 votes to end a filibuster instead of 60, or requiring the minority party to continuously hold the Senate floor. In a private call leaked to TheIntercept.com, he showed receptiveness to such measures, and he could reasonably argue they'd strengthen the filibuster by making it harder for the minority to abuse it. H.R. 1 is a reckless bill that shows exactly why the filibuster is needed, said Yuval Levin in NationalReview.com. Like the state bills Democrats bemoan, it wouldn't do much to affect voter turnout, which is less easily influenced by access rules than many believe. By federalizing elections in a purely partisan way would contribute to the public's loss of confidence in our elections, which is the real threat to American democracy. This overly ambitious bill never had a chance of passage, said Andrew Prokop in Vox.com. Democrats have known that all along, which meant moderates unhappy with parts of the bill could back it publicly while knowing it wouldn't become law anyway. Manchin and Sinema aren't about to throw out the filibuster, and President Biden, who needs their support for bills with a more plausible path to success, isn't about to arm twist them. So what can congressional Democrats do in response to state voter suppression laws? The answer increasingly looks like nothing. We've got a second, shorter main story. The Supreme Court deals a dramatic blow to the NCAA. What happened? In a landmark ruling that could completely transform college sports, the Supreme Court this week ruled that the NCAA's cap on education-related benefits to student-athletes violated antitrust law. Justice Neil Gorsuch's opinion in the court's 9-0 decision in NCAA versus Alston on behalf of former West Virginia University running back Sean Alston and other college athletes is technically narrow in scope but opens the door to more legal attacks. The NCAA's business model would be flatly illegal in most any other industry in America, Brett Kavanaugh wrote in a blunt concurrence that extended Gorsuch's reasoning. There are serious questions whether the NCAA's remaining compensation rules can pass muster. The NCAA, which includes athletic programs at more than 1,100 colleges and universities, argued that its 115-year-old tradition of amateurism is central to its existence. But the court questioned what amateurism means in a multi-billion-dollar commercial enterprise. Gorsuch noted that NCAA President Mark Emmert draws a $4 million salary, college athletic directors average more than $1 million, and Division I football coaches make as much as $11 million a year, while players face penalties for receiving anything that goes beyond covering basic expenses. The NCAA faces an additional challenge from state laws that give players greater control over their names, images, and likenesses, including the freedom to sign endorsement deals. Such laws go into effect in six states on July 1st. What the columnist said. The NCAA should put a sign out. This property is condemned, said Sally Jenkins in the Washington Post. The court yanked out the cracked old cornerstone that held up the NCAA's rickety, exploitive structure. Kavanaugh dismissed the NCAA's appeal to amateurism, writing that nowhere else in America can businesses get away with agreeing not to pay their workers a fair market rate on the theory that their product is defined by not paying their workers a fair market rate. Those sentences mean the total collapse of the NCAA's rotten edifice. Don't be so ready to cheer this, said Paul Zeiss in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. The ruling could force smaller schools that don't have huge conference TV contract checks to shut down their programs. The losers then will be athletes like my own children, two of whom had their education fully paid for as Division I athletes. I am all for athletes getting their fair share, but the end of the line here is many schools simply shutting down their Division I programs. Yes, maybe smaller schools drop sports entirely, Maybe larger schools become affiliates of professional teams, said Will Leitch in NYMag.com. But if Brett Kavanaugh isn't convinced by your appeal to hallowed tradition, it probably needs to end. College sports may be hard to fix, but anyone using that fact as an excuse to maintain an unjust system has neither the law nor time on their side. Our controversy of the week is critical race theory, manufactured outrage, or real threat. At the urging of Governor Ron DeSantis, Florida's Board of Education last week joined six other Republican-led states in voting to ban the teaching of critical race theory, CRT. There's only one small problem, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. CRT isn't taught in Florida schools or anywhere in America outside of a few graduate-level law schools, where it was developed in the 1970s to explore and explain the stark racial disparities in criminal justice, housing, and other institutions. The cynical DeSantis, a master right-wing culture warrior in Donald Trump's mold, is pandering to white voters who aren't quite sure what critical race theory is, but know they don't like it. The imaginary threat of CRT has been cited some 1,300 times on Fox News since March, said Paul Waldman, also in the Post. The conservative think tanker behind the CRT panic, 36-year-old Christopher Rufo, has cheerfully admitted his plan was to hijack this academic term and turn it toxic, adding, "The goal is to have the public read something crazy in the newspaper and immediately think critical race theory. By making all discussions of racism toxic, the right's goal is to limit what our children are taught about slavery, Jim Crow, and the rest of America's ugly racial history on the grounds that it might make white people feel bad." The left is playing word games, said John McWhorter in johnmcwhorter.substack.com. By defining CRT narrowly as the contents of some obscure law review articles from decades ago, they're trying to discredit all pushback against a very real and distressing ideology of racial essentialism that is permeating schools nationwide. The essence of this teaching is that the American story is mainly one of oppression and racism. Fox News didn't invent the fact that a school in California made its third graders rank themselves by racial power and privilege. Sneering progressives may pretend that kids aren't being taught the leftist doctrine that we are all defined by our race, said Charles Cook in NationalReview.com, or that our nation's founding ideals were a cynical and self-serving lie. Tell that to the legion of parents from coast to coast who are objecting to what their kids are actually being taught. The toxic content of CRT is bad enough, said Gerard Baker in the Wall Street Journal. But even worse is CRT's insistence on itself as absolute final truth. If you dissent, you are exhibiting false consciousness and white fragility and are defending white male hegemony. This adamant refusal to engage in debate makes racialism more of a religion than a legitimate approach to education, which is supposed to foster the nurturing and development of independent minds. Oh, please, said Moira Donegan in TheGuardian.com. If conservatives were genuinely concerned about free speech and independent thinking, would they be passing unconstitutional laws literally telling teachers that certain ideas are verboten? The attack on CRT is a transparent effort to advance the right's preferred narrative of race in American history, one that places racism squarely in the past as the personal moral failing of a few long-dead Americans. The question of how to teach our children about America's troubled racial past and present is as important as it is complicated, said Jim Swift in TheBulwark.com. Sadly, though, its new status as a culture war battleground almost guarantees that the fight will be long, arduous, and ultimately unwinnable by either side. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for atheists, who are just as happy overall as those with strong religious faith, according to a new meta-analysis by the University of Cologne. Based on data from 24 countries, the study found both groups reporting high degrees of life satisfaction, while the weakly religious were the least happy. It was a good week for rocking the shot, after the Foo Fighters played to a capacity crowd of 20,000 vaccinated-only fans at New York's Madison Square Garden, the first concert at the iconic arena in more than a year. A handful of anti-vaxxers protested outside. It was a good week for 90s nostalgia, after a performance in Los Angeles by BackSync, a supergroup comprising four middle-aged members of the rival late 90s boy bands, the Backstreet Boys and NSYNC. Joey Fatone of NSYNC told fans, "Now it's okay to like both." But it was a bad week for Jeff Bezos, with 20,000 signatures and counting on a tongue-in-cheek Change.org petition calling for the Amazon.com founder to be denied re-entry to Earth after his self-funded space flight next month because he's, quote, an evil overlord hell-bent on global domination. It's a bad week for the Girl Scouts, who find themselves with 15 million unsold boxes of their eponymous cookies since the pandemic limited door-to-door selling and cookie booths. "This is unfortunate," said spokeswoman Kelly Parisi, "but it was to be expected." Finally, it was a bad week for the grouchy, after Canon, the Japanese camera giant, deployed new AI technology that will prevent employees from entering meeting rooms unless they're smiling. A spokesperson said Canon hopes to create a positive atmosphere by utilizing this system. And a short in other news piece before we move on. Nearly 900 COVID cases at U.S. Secret Service. A public records request revealed this week that 881 Secret Service employees, most of them agents working protection jobs, tested positive for COVID-19 between March 1, 2020 and March 9, 2021. The agency noted that its employees were in continuous contact with the public during the pandemic at campaign events, White House gatherings, and the January inauguration. At the height of the pandemic, then-President Trump insisted on proceeding with speeches, private events, and vacations. Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, the watchdog group that uncovered the records, said the disclosure was evidence that many Secret Service agents got the coronavirus due to the callous behavior of the Trump administration. And the briefing page, as referenced in the cover drawing, the West's mega drought. California and the Southwest face soaring temperatures, severe drought, and a hotter and drier new normal. What's the current situation? The West is in the midst of a widespread drought emergency of historic intensity. 72% of the West is under severe drought conditions, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor. And more than 25% is in an exceptional drought, the most extreme category. Many reservoirs are at record lows. Last month, Lake Mead, which provides water for 25 million people, hit its lowest level since it was filled in the 1930s. Mountain snowpack, which usually feeds reservoirs during the dry months through melting, is nearly non-existent. And though it's not even summer yet, a record-setting heat wave baked the already parched region last week, sending temperatures up to 107 in Salt Lake, 116 in Las Vegas, and 118 in Phoenix. The current drought is on track to become the worst that we've seen in the last 1,200 years, said Kathleen Johnson, a paleoclimatologist at the University of California, Irvine. What's behind the conditions? The immediate cause is record low precipitation over the past year combined with above average temperatures. In Arizona, California, New Mexico, and Nevada, the past year has been the driest on record since record keeping began in 1895. In Utah, it's the second driest. High heat intensifies the drought. In turn, that worsens the heat as soil moisture, which normally reduces heat through evaporation, declines. Droughts in this region are cyclical, but experts agree climate change is making this one, which has already lasted 20 years, far more severe. In a study published last year in the journal Science, researchers determined that climate change made drought conditions 46% worse between 2000 and 2018. We're living in a new climate, said Stanford University climatologist Noah Diffenbaugh, in which these water deficits primarily result from the influence of warming temperature. What are the consequences? Farmers deprived of water can't grow their crops. We're looking at an absolutely catastrophic year, said Ryan Jacobson in the Fresno County Farm Bureau. In New Mexico, vast swaths of farmland are being taken out of use at the urging of state officials. In California, up to 1 million acres of farmland could go unused this year at an economic cost of billions. Many of the 2 million Californians who rely on well water may find no groundwater to tap. Electricity production from dams has dropped, and a hydropower plant at California's Lake Oroville faced a possible shutdown due to plummeting water levels last week, even as scorching temperatures strained the power grid. Perhaps most ominously, the tinderbox conditions threaten a cataclysmic wildfire season that could surpass even last year's. All of these conditions are deeply worrisome for this summer, but they're part of a broader trend that could spell trouble for the region's future. What is the broader trend? Scientists suspect the Southwest is in the grip of a mega drought, a severe drought that lasts for decades. In a study published last year, scientists who analyzed ancient tree rings identified four such mega droughts over the past 1,200 years and said the one underway may equal the worst of them. And climate change may keep this drought locked in. Many scientists now speak of aridification instead of drought, to indicate a permanent condition instead of a passing problem, a new normal. To make matters worse, the mega drought arrives at a time when the Southwest's population is booming. Arizona, Nevada, Texas, and Utah are all among the fastest growing states in the nation. We've always been dry, but we didn't have all these people, said Ed Bowler of St. George, Utah, where the population has grown nearly sevenfold since 1980. What can be done? Communities are going to have to adapt to a hotter, drier, new reality, which means making some hard choices. The region needs to drastically increase our conservation and rethink how we are using almost every gallon of water, said John Intsminger, general manager of Southern Nevada Water Authority. There may have to be fewer farms in the Southwest, with water rights transferred from agricultural to urban usage, said Utah State University ecologist Michelle Baker. Water-intensive landscaping of grass and bushes will need to give way to less thirsty native plantings, driven by laws like in Nevada that newly prohibits decorative turf. States will have to figure out how to live with smaller water allocations from the diminished Colorado River, which serves 40 million people over seven states. Some experts are optimistic that the region can adapt, but others are less sanguine, pointing out that climate change is only going to accelerate. It's just going to get hotter, said Brad Udall, a climate scientist at Colorado State University. You ain't seen nothing yet. The overtapped Colorado River. As the Southwest broils in 100-plus degree temperatures, the Colorado River offers both a marker of the drought's intensity and a harbinger of coming battles over dwindling water supplies. Seven states draw from the river under a plan drawn up in 1922. But from the outset, that plan allotted more water than the river actually provided. And that shortage has worsened as the river's flow has declined by 20%, while the population that drinks from it has boomed. The river-fed reservoirs Lake Powell and Lake Mead, which together provide water for 40 million people, are both about 35% full. In 2019, the states struck an agreement, the Colorado River Drought Contingency Plan, that triggers mandatory water cuts once Lake Mead drops to a certain point, and is widely expected to happen this summer. But it expires in 2026, and the states will have to hammer out a new deal that will include painful reductions in their water allocations. That will require fraught negotiations between competing interests, including cities, developers, farmers, conservationists, and native tribes. This is the new baseline, said Eric Kuhn, former general manager of the Colorado River District. There's no more water left in the system. Time to read a few of the best columns of the week. We'll start with two from the U.S. First, how not to celebrate Juneteenth. Juneteenth is now a federal holiday, and that has me worried, said Erica Smith. I understand why so many black Americans are jubilant. June 19th is the anniversary of the day when the black slaves in Texas were told by Union soldiers that they were legally free, and has been a holiday for black Americans to celebrate generations of resilience. By making it an official national holiday, President Biden may help the rest of the country understand its importance. Still, America has a way of squeezing the meaning out of holidays, replacing the original intent with insipid slogans and sales events. Will Macy's soon offer Juneteenth weekend discounts? Will McDonald's and Cheesecake Factory start selling strawberry shakes and red beans to honor the black tradition of eating red foods to symbolize the blood of our ancestors? Corporations will no doubt to seek to exploit Juneteenth to build cachet for their brands. Meanwhile, the descendants of slaves will continue to be underemployed and underpaid, with far less family wealth than other Americans. Ultimately, I suspect it will be up to black people to hold on to the true meaning of Juneteenth, so its power isn't commoditized, diluted, and sold off. The court's victory for pluralism. In a key culture war ruling, the Supreme Court last week delivered a recipe for peace, said Stephen Chapman. All nine justices sided with Catholic Social Services, which was denied a contract with the city of Philadelphia because it will not place foster children with same-sex couples. Philadelphia had claimed the agency's adherence to its religious beliefs amounted to discrimination against gays, even though the organization said it would simply refer such parents to one of the many agencies that don't exclude same-sex couples. The ultimate disservice to children would have been a ban on conservative religious groups in foster care, since they have long played an integral role in that system. America is a nation with a kaleidoscope of differences in race, religion, culture, ideology, and more. For those with differing values to insist that their rights must prevail in every context, no matter what, is to stoke fierce, relentless conflict. Just as religious groups cannot deny gay couples the right to marry and raise children, those organizations should not be forced to violate their own long-standing moral teaching. That's pluralism, the binding force that allows us to live together despite fundamental differences. This is a How They See Us International column. A failed drug war turns 50. It is now 50 years since the U.S. launched its war on drugs, said Jose Melendez and Victor Sancho, a conflict that has achieved little besides corrupting Latin American democracy. The war began on June 17, 1971, when President Richard Nixon, angry that Vietnam veterans were coming home addicted to heroin and eager to distract the public from civil rights protest, declared drug abuse to be public enemy number one. The U.S. has since funneled more than $1 trillion into its drug war. Yet last year, a record 90,000 Americans died of an overdose. In Latin America, the toll is incalculable. Governments in the region were forced to crack down hard on drug production and trafficking to avoid being hit with U.S. sanctions. Those crackdowns simply drove up drug prices, making the trade vastly more profitable and empowering the cartels. When governments tried to squash them, the gangs began buying off cops, then mayors, then judges, then senators, then presidents. The war caused a domino effect, as each corrupt politician in turn corrupted another. And now the criminality involves political parties, businessmen, and bankers in a network of corruption across Latin America. The drug war has been the mother of all failures, said Andres Hoyos. The U.S. spent more than $1 billion on Plan Colombia in the 2000s, a State Department-led operation that saw tons of toxic herbicide sprayed from the air on illegal coca fields. And for what? The area dedicated to coca cultivation fell, but production remained stable because farmers planted new coca varieties that yielded more cocaine alkaloid. Cocaine is now a $10 billion a year industry in Colombia, more than oil and coal combined. And the fight to control valuable trafficking routes to the U.S. has sent murder rates spiking across Latin America. The region today has 8% of the world's population, but 38% of its homicides. Bolivia is showing a better way, said Guillermo Guerat. After Evo Morales became the country's first indigenous president in 2006, he kicked out the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration and drew up a new constitution that protects the coca leaf, used in the Andes for thousands of years as a mild stimulant, and puts its production into the hands of coca growers' unions. Since then, violence has stopped and the conversion of coca into cocaine has decreased. So why are the rest of us still fighting, asked Antonio Salgado Borges. Why have our governments participated for half a century in a drug war that does not make sense in principle, does not work in practice, and every day harms the lives of millions of people? We're playing an endless game of whack-a-mole because prohibition incentivizes the production of dangerous new designer drugs that evade legal framework. It's time to cut our losses and legalize, regulate, and tax the entire recreational drug industry. Not one more person should lose their life to a stupid war that can never be won. The last word, our in-depth article, is titled, A Ticket to the Insurrection. Jeff Sable was a well-educated geophysicist from a blue-leaning county, said Melanie Warner in Politico.com. Yet polarizing presidential rhetoric and personal demons seem to have led him to the front of the Capitol riot. The text message showed up on John Bergman's phone in late January. Sent to him by a former work colleague, it came with the question, have you seen this? And linked to an article and video from a news channel. Bergman pressed play. It was a scene from the Capitol riot on January 6th. Amid a throng of rioters outside the building's Western Terrace Tunnel was a figure wearing a tan Carhartt jacket, teal backpack, steel-toed boots, and black tactical helmet. The article identified the man as Bergman's longtime friend, Jeffrey Sable. In the video, Sable vaulted over a railing and appeared to drag a defenseless cop down a set of stairs. Bergman could barely fathom what he was seeing. He had worked with Sable for a decade and known him for 18 years. "I've always revered Jeff as one of the most intelligent, capable, thoughtful, helping people," Bergman said. "We had just spoken a few weeks earlier, and the next thing I know, he's in Washington, D.C., doing this crazy thing." Sable, 51, is a geophysicist from Kittredge, Colorado, a small town in the mountains outside Denver. In the weeks after the insurrection, he became one of the more than 500 people charged so far for their participation in the January 6th insurrection. Sable faces 8 counts, several of them felonies, including the assault of police officers. He and 4 other defendants named in the same indictment are accused of participating in some of the day's worst violence, which took place about 4:30 p.m. and resulted in several officers being stripped of their protective gear, dragged, stomped on, and attacked with crutches and a flagpole. Sable, who is divorced and has 3 teenagers back home in Colorado, also seems to appear in a YouTube video shot about 2 hours earlier and unearthed by a Twitter user who is part of a group of self-styled sedition hunters. In it, Sable, known to the sedition hunters as hashtag RNNTeal because of his highly identifiable jacket and backpack, runs headfirst into a row of officers trying to hold the line and prevent rioters from breaching the west steps of the Capitol. Denied bail, Sable is now locked in a cell in Washington, D.C., awaiting trial, deemed by a judge to be the epitome of a flight risk because of what he did after the riots. Unlike defendants who posted about their Capitol exploits on social media, Sable seems to have immediately grasped the gravity of his predicament. Back home in Colorado, he destroyed electronic devices in his microwave and instructed friends to delete anything he had sent them. Several days later, he arrived at Logan Airport in Boston with a ticket to Zurich, Switzerland. Worried he had been recognized, he never got on the plane. Instead, he rented a car and drove to New York State, eventually ending up in a suburb of New York City. At some point along the way, he tossed his phone off a bridge and grew so distraught that he attempted to take his own life by slashing his wrists and thighs, his criminal complaint states. "I've really been struggling with this, that my bro tried to kill himself," Bergman says, his voice cracking with emotion. "It scared the shit out of me." Born in Utica, New York, Jeffrey Patrick Sable grew up in nearby Waterville, a small picturesque town of 1600 in Oneida County. According to letters sent to the court on Sable's behalf by family and friends, his dad taught chemistry and physics at the local high school, and his mom worked as a nurse. All 3 Sable children went to college and into promising careers. Jeff's younger sister became a dentist in the Army and several years ago was promoted to colonel. His older brother, a National Merit Scholar, went into tax law before deciding to become a teacher. Jeff was also an impressive student, graduating 3rd in his high school class and studying physics at SUNY Cortland. Sable's attorney, John Norris, who declined to comment for this article and did not respond to a list of specific questions, instructed Sable's friends and family members who wrote character letters not to speak either. Still, aspects of Sable's life story can be pieced together from friends and family who are willing to speak, as well as from public documents. After college, Sable headed west, eventually taking a job in the Denver area office of ECC, a construction and remediation company that worked on military contracts to remove unexploded weaponry from bases and other areas. Teams would often excavate hundreds of pieces of scrap metal for each munition recovered. "Jeff just loved it, though he did go to some of the most god-awful places for like 6 months," said Todd Kerbs, who befriended Sable in the early 2000s when they played on opposing Colorado rugby teams. Kerb says he declined Sable's offer to buy him a ticket to accompany him to D.C. for Trump's rally on January 6. Among the more appealing destinations Sable was dispatched to was Maui, where he met the woman who would become his wife, Sherry Strotz, in the late 1990s. Sabo had been assigned to a 12-month project on the tiny Hawaiian island of Kehoolawe, which served as a weapons testing site after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. When the project ended, Strotz accompanied Sabo back to Colorado. The couple bought a house in the small mountain community of Indian Hills, next door to Kittredge, and raised three children. In his free time, Sabo went mountain climbing, camping, and dirt biking, and worked in his garage on a project to build a new snowboarding device, which he called the Revolver, that lets riders turn their front foot on the board for greater comfort in the lift line or a more exhilarating ride down the mountain. After working on it for 20 years, Sabo hoped to start production with a crowdfunding campaign. "He's a MacGyver-type dude," said Kerbs. Over the past decade, several parts of Sabo's life unraveled, according to interviews and court records. In 2011, Strotz filed for divorce. In an interview, she said Sabo began drinking heavily and acting strange. Then, in 2014, Sabo's older brother died suddenly of a heart attack, leaving him devastated. During this period, Sabo found a large measure of stability with a woman he met while back home in Waterville one summer with his kids, according to the character letters. After a year of dating, she quit her job at a nursing home to relocate to Colorado, moving into Sabo's modest split-level four-bedroom rental in Kittredge. By this point, Sabo's strong political views were already well-established. According to Strotz, herself a registered Republican, they took root after Barack Obama was elected president in 2008. She denies race had anything to do with it. "It was Obama as a person. He would freak out. He hated that Obama became president, and he hated Democrats. He became obsessed." Around this time, John Bergman, Sabo's friend and former co-worker, remembers Sabo attaching a "Don't Tread on Me" sticker to his old blue Ford pickup truck. Strotz says when she and Sabo were together, she witnessed what she refers to as his bad side, an angry streak in moods that would change quickly. In 2016, according to the county court records, Sabo was charged with misdemeanor child abuse. Strotz said Sabo had injured their then 15-year-old son. The charge was dismissed after Sabo paid fines and completed probation, a mental health evaluation, and counseling. In 2018, he decided to give up custody of his son to Strotz, she said. "Jeff stood in my home and told my fiancé and I that he could no longer continue to do his 50% of parenting time with his son, or he would end up in jail." Whatever was triggering Sabo's anger at home didn't appear to carry over into other circles. Bergman says he didn't experience his friend's mood swings, though he describes an unusual intensity Sabo brought to his work at ECC. "I would leave the office at 5 p.m., and the next morning he'd still be there when I got in at 8 a.m. Sometimes he'd be there for two nights. He'd get into something and then just go." In 2020, Sabo's fervor found new outlets. As a geophysicist working on government contracts, Sabo had long been troubled by what he saw as the unchecked power and waste of military spending, according to Kerbs. "Because of his work, he saw the other side, how corrupt it is," Kerbs says, of Sabo's job cleaning up unused or discarded U.S. taxpayer-funded military weaponry. After the 2020 election, according to prosecutors, Sabo grew focused on then-President Donald Trump's claims that liberals and Democrats had rigged the election and flew to Washington in December to attend political rallies. "Jeff has always cared very deeply about his country. He's the kind of guy, if he felt something was wrong, he'd want to try and change it," said Bergman, who adds he is dismayed that Sabo's passions wound up being channeled into Trump's lies. "The way I look at it is, how could you fall for that guy?" In a video that one of Sabo's friends shot and posted on Facebook, and that Strotz described to me, Sabo and his friend walked calmly along the National Mall after Trump's speech earlier in the day on January 6th. Sabo is wearing a baseball hat. "I was really nervous seeing that video, knowing Jeff was there, but I thought, oh, okay, he's going to be okay," Strotz says of watching the video that day. It has since been taken down. Not long afterward, Strotz said, the friend returned to the Willard Intercontinental Hotel where he and Sabo and other Trump supporters including Roger Stone, were staying. Sabol decided to remain at the rally, eventually walking to the Capitol and swapping his hat for a helmet. A few weeks later, the friend called Strotz, she says, to apologize for leaving Jeff alone. Understanding how someone crosses the threshold from belief to action isn't easy. While many of those arrested for political terrorism in recent decades have been young, underemployed, and socially isolated, the majority of the 465 defendants in the Capitol attack are much like Sabol, older individuals, mostly white men, and with well-established careers. The majority of the defendants, including Sabol, also came not from the heart of Trump country, but from counties Biden won. Sabol's actions have left many in his life confused and grappling for answers. Of the millions of people who believe the election was stolen, tens of thousands converged on Washington that day to protest and hear Trump speak. Of these, thousands stormed the Capitol grounds in an attempt to disrupt the counting of Electoral College votes in the Senate. And of these, the FBI believes hundreds acted violently. For researchers on extremism, that's the white whale, trying to understand what makes someone turn violent, says Bennett Clifford, a researcher at George Washington University's program on extremism. A lot of it is determined by individual circumstances and vulnerabilities. Todd Kerb, Sabol's rugby friend, believes Sabol, whom he calls Jeffro, experienced something resembling a psychological break while at the Capitol, a moment in which he lost control. He fell off the edge for about a minute, but I know for 1,000% fact that he didn't go there with any ill intentions. He just wanted to observe and see what was going on. Kerb says he thinks Sabol was wearing steel-toed boots and a tactical helmet and carrying a radio and zip ties in his bag, as prosecutors allege, because he had been anticipating confrontations with anti-Trump counter-protesters who had clashed violently with Trump supporters several weeks earlier during a December Stop the Steal rally in D.C. For his part, Bergman says he doesn't really know what happened to his friend that day. He's been thinking about how the mob mentality of the crowd and the charged rhetoric from a U.S. president might have ignited whatever long-simmering rage Sabol had toward political figures, anger that might have stayed just below the surface if it were not for the past few years in American politics. At the same time, he can't excuse what Sabol did. At that moment, he thought he could initiate change by causing violence, and that feels like terrorism, Bergman says. If I didn't know Jeff, I'd say throw the book at him. This was adapted from an article that originally appeared in Politico.com. Here's a health and science piece. New problems for COVID long haulers. Nearly one in four people who survived COVID-19 go on to seek medical care for new health problems at least a month after their initial infection, new research suggests. In the largest study to date of so-called long haulers, researchers track the health insurance records of nearly 2 million people who contracted the coronavirus last year, reports the New York Times. More than half were asymptomatic. 40% had mild or moderate symptoms, and only 5% were hospitalized. Overall, almost one quarter, 23%, sought medical treatment for new conditions 1 month or more after COVID diagnosis. These new health problems occurred in both adults and children and included nearly half the patients who were hospitalized with COVID, 27% of those who had mild or moderate symptoms, and 19% of the asymptomatic cases. The most common new ailment was nerve and muscle pain, which affected 5%, followed by breathing difficulties and conditions such as brain fog, fatigue, and malaise. Some of the new patients may have had these ailments pre-infection, but simply never had them diagnosed. Yet researchers say the findings demonstrate the widespread and varied effects of the virus. The study drives home the point that long COVID can affect nearly every organ system. says Zaid Al-Ali, who has carried out similar research. People with long COVID need multidisciplinary care. And we'll turn over to finish out on the talking points page. We'll start with Catholicism. The bishops go after Biden. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops has decided to try to shame the nation's second Catholic president, said Ed Kilgore in nymag.com. In a stunning move, its 400 members last week voted overwhelmingly to create a document of the Eucharist, advancing a years-long effort to deny Biden and other pro-choice Catholic politicians communion. Though administering the sacrament remains a decision for individual clergy and dioceses, a landscape of hostile bishops or priests could make it embarrassing for Biden, a lifelong Catholic who regularly attends Mass to practice his faith. Even the Vatican does not support this patently bad idea, said the National Catholic Reporter in an editorial. The Eucharist is not the reward of saints, Pope Francis said. It is the bread of sinners. But if American bishops go ahead and pick the fight, it will just seal the deal on the branding of Catholicism in the United States as a culture war project, a hypocritical extension of Republican politics, like evangelical Protestantism, and further empty the pews. Abortion isn't just any issue, said David Fredoso in the Washington Examiner, and Biden isn't just any Catholic. Killing the innocent unborn is a grave sin, and to allow the world's most powerful invisible man to impersonate a member of our community tells other Catholics the church's teaching on abortion is strictly optional. Biden used to waffle on his pro-choice politics, saying he personally believed that life begins at conception, said Brooke Stanton in NationalReview.com. But in running for president, he surrendered to the abortion-celebrating extremists in his party. Now he even supports repealing the Hyde Amendment, which bans federal funding for most abortions. The bishops should stand firm. Church leaders appear to have forgotten the bigotry of our first Catholic president faced, that our first Catholic president faced, said Karen Tumulty in the Washington Post. In 1960, some equated Catholic teachings to socialism. John F. Kennedy was forced to reassure Americans' Protestant majority that he would not take orders from Rome or his bishop, and that his primary loyalty would be to the U.S. Constitution. Despite Catholic teaching, Roe v. Wade is the law of the land, and the bishop's threat to withhold spiritual sustenance from Biden risks undermining all Catholic politicians. For many non-Catholics, it will mean that the doubts about that JFK sought to put to rest will be justified. Obamacare, here to stay. For a third time, the U.S. Supreme Court has saved President Obama's landmark health care law from Republican attempts to dismantle and destroy it, said Matt Ford in NewRepublic.com. In a 7-2 ruling last week, the justices rejected a lawsuit from 18 Republican-controlled states, arguing that because Congress in 2017 reduced the tax penalty for not buying health insurance to $0, the entire Affordable Care Act should be struck down. The states could not show the ACA injured them, the court ruled, so they had no standing to sue. The ACA now provides insurance to 31 million people, and more than 70% of Americans, including 60% of Republicans, support the ACA's most popular provisions, such as guaranteeing that insurers can't discriminate against those with pre-existing conditions. The justices have made it clear. The ACA is here to stay. Liberals should thank Chief Justice John Roberts, said David French in FrenchPress.TheDispatch.com. Despite the court's 6-3 conservative majority, Roberts always has one eye on the institutional credibility of his court, steering his colleagues away from nakedly partisan decisions. The Roberts rule seems to be that opponents of major legislation should focus on winning elections more than winning cases. Two of President Trump's appointees, Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett, sided with Roberts, said Matt Lewis in thedailybeast.com. During her confirmation hearings, Barrett was dismissed as a partisan hack and religious nut, but she's proven that conservative justices really do prioritize the rule of law over their own political leanings. What about Samuel Alito and Neil Gorsuch, who voted for the plaintiffs, asked Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. What about the 20 Republicans attorneys general who signed onto this laughably flimsy case? Right-wingers still view Obamacare's passage as a traumatic event and haven't accepted its legitimacy. With this victory, said Catherine Rampell in WashingtonPost.com, Democrats can start playing offense and prioritize the millions of poor people who fell through Obamacare's cracks. 12 GOP-controlled states still refuse to adopt the ACA's Medicaid expansion, which lowered the income threshold for government-backed health insurance. Creating a public option, a low-cost government insurance program to compete with private insurers, might be the best way to provide coverage to those who need it most, the red state poor. On the poll watch, 67% of Americans believe they can now find a new job if they want one. Among those who have jobs, 43% want to return to the workplace, 31% prefer working from home, and 26% want a hybrid. And we'll finish out the show with a quote from comedian Phyllis Diller, who says, I'm at an age when my back goes out more than I do. With that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.